welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
107 minutes in, Red Skull has gone, well, to quote Mr. Spock and that techno-pop band, the Information Society, he's gone to pure energy. So,
oh my gosh, Information Society. I have that. I still have that on vinyl, probably, and cassette and CD too. Yes,
Hal, I want to know what you're feeling about this
minute.
Or
to quote Monty Python, he's pining for the fjords.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
All right, go ahead, X, please. Red Skull.
Well, tell me what's on your mind, Hal.
I want to know what you're thinking. I'm just going to sit here and quote Information Society lyrics. And I think of all the people in the world, who most of them are listening right now. I don't know if they were ever on your radar, Brian, but synthopop mid-80s who sampled a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah. Oh, this is new to me. I'm going to do some searching afterwards.
Yeah, I may drop this in as a sound bed in the background if it doesn't, just as long as it doesn't hit any copyright stuff. But yeah, pure energy.
Pure energy.
I think you're going to have to. My gosh, I haven't listened to that in quite a few years, but not as long as you might think. It hasn't been 40. All right, minute 107, in honor of what? The 107th, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Aboard the Valkyrie, Steve Rogers grips the controls, his face set as he assesses his dire situation. "But I can try and force it down," he says into the radio. At the Hydra base control room, Colonel Phillips signals Jim Morita, and they exit swiftly. Peggy's voice crackles through, urgent. "I'll get Howard on the line. He'll know what to do." "There's not enough time," Steve counters, his eyes fixed on the display showing New York as the target. "This thing's moving too fast, and it's heading for New York. I got to put her in the water." "Please, don't do this," Peggy pleads. "We have time. We can work it out." "Right now, I'm in the middle of nowhere," Steve says, his voice steady but heavy. "If I wait any longer, a lot of people are going to die. Peggy, this is my choice." He sets his compass, with Peggy's photo inside, on the control panel and pushes the yoke, diving the Valkyrie toward the icy ocean below. "Peggy?" "I'm here," Peggy replies, her voice soft but resolute. Oh, so much, so much happening here.
Okay,
so much emotion.
I immediately have an airplane question, Hal. As our pilot, he's got the yoke, which I'm assuming he's got at least two axes of control. He can go left, right, or up and down.
Right.
So there's a lot of more choices besides down. What about other choices? I mean, he might not have the rudders, but I don't know how much of an Immelman he could perform. It's like, well, why don't you aim this thing back at Berlin?
You could just turn it around. Now, I mean, you know, granted, we're assuming that he doesn't know anything about flying or anything, but presuming this is a traditional control setup, there's no reason to think he wouldn't. He would have pitch and roll in this, and a flying wing design would have pedals, but there are no traditional vertical rudders. Those controls would be mixed in to apply differential aileron to give you that third axis. So in a flying wing of almost any kind, compared to almost any other sort of configuration, you could fly it all day with just the yoke, and you know, feel a little bit sloppy and uncoordinated, but it would work just fine. So he would have every ability to turn around. And at least he knows that forward is down. I mean, he's figured that much that much out, and that may not be intuitive to everybody.
We talked a few minutes ago about how much flight training Steve might have had. He managed to pilot that little buzz bomb pretty well.
That's a good point.
He brought it around 360 degrees and came in the rear of the Red Skull's wing, and so he's got at least some intuitive grasp of flight.
And it makes you wonder, assuming if we say that those manned flying bombs were not somehow would presumably be an outgrowth of things that mainline Germany was already working on, and they, you know, we can certainly draw some dotted lines to things that they really were in real life, but even in the even in this universe, say, okay, Germany was building this and Hydra is taking it and adapting it and perfecting it. You know, one of the things for a weapon like that would be just as they did with one of the earlier jets, the Heinkel 162 Salamander, the controls were kept as simple and straightforward as possible because they were later in the war, they were training Hitler Youth to fly. So it wouldn't translate to the flying wing, but there's a very plausible case to be made for the idea that those bombs would have, the controls would be as basic and as rudimentary as they possibly could be. I mean, you'd still have basic stick and rudder and probably power, but yeah, an interesting thought that he was able to bring it back around.
We do get an answer to a question we had, I believe, in the last minute or maybe the one before that, as to the readout of the functioning of the flying wing. We couldn't decide if the animation was showing us that two engines were out or two engines were working. And 22 seconds in here, we see two contrails coming off the back of the flying wing.
Oh, yep.
That look like they're from the they correspond to the engines in the animation. So I think what we're supposed to think is that this thing's working on 1/4 power. Two out of eight are working.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it looks to be like those two center jet engines.
Yeah.
And in the on the display on the panel, as we were debating how to read that, it looks like the two jet engines were working and possibly one of the piston engines, but
I thought the contrails were a little off center. Like they were off to the left a little.
They might be as I'm scrubbing back and forth. I get so distracted because that top down shot of it flying along between the cloud layers is so gorgeous.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's just beautiful.
The sepia tone on top of it. I mean, I was feeling big Sky Captain vibes out of that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's got warmth. There's blue, but it's still a very warm shot. And there's this tragic and ironic beauty to it. It shouldn't be beautiful. This thing's either meant to kill a lot of people or Cap's got to do something horrible himself. There's nothing beautiful about it, but that's just poetic.
And is the screen showing some kind of ice flows below him? I couldn't figure out. That map doesn't seem to relate to anything. I was thinking, well, maybe it's the St. Lawrence Seaway or something, but it doesn't really correspond with any map, like a piece of Greenland or.
I took it to be the St. Lawrence, but I don't know. Interesting. Yeah.
It's hard to tell without knowing the zoom level.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be, I mean, and I would think the St. Lawrence Seaway would be too south for him.
Yeah. There is a neat transition here. I just like the cut Joe Johnston makes between the animation in the display in the cockpit and then the overview of the flying wing from outside of it looking down in the clouds, as you just pointed out. They're at different angles, but they have the same feel to them. And the fact that the indicator on the display is the triangular shape of a flying wing, it really ties those two together. It tells us exactly what we're looking at, and then it cuts to the thing we're looking at. And it just makes all the intuitive sense in the world.
It really does. And, you know, speaking of that, as we were talking about, okay, well, where is he? Where could he be? The fact that we're also seeing them moving at roughly equivalent relative speeds.
Exactly.
So the flying wing is, it's close enough to clouds. We're getting a sense of speed. But when you see that on that indicator, the fact that it's moving that quickly means we are zoomed in pretty tight.
Yeah.
On the moving map on the screen itself. True. So.
And we can't be in this minute without noting the direct Joe Johnston, let's stick girlfriend on the instrument panel picture that is now 2 for 2.
2 for 2, a Rocketeer. Yeah. And this. I remember we talked when we did that episode of the Rocketeer Minute. I remember talking about that because, when I was 18, I did that same thing on an airplane that I was learning to fly in. And I told that this story back on that episode. But long story short, I got out of the airplane and left the picture there. And then only to find out, like, I couldn't find it. And then a couple of days later, find out that at the time, Heidi, who I was dating from back home, had become very popular at our flight school. Everybody enjoyed flying with her, thought she was a good luck charm, and some people wanted a copy of the picture. I said, nope. There's that word again. But it was the one and only time that I ever left it there.
Oh, that's sweet, though. I like that.
And the little thing.
Yeah, I think she appreciated it at the time.
The other thing I noticed is that Peggy didn't give him that picture. He cut it out of a newspaper.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you remember there's an earlier scene where she sees him in, is it newsreel footage?
Yeah. Yeah, with the compass.
And she spots the compass open and sees the picture of herself. And she's surprised because how does he have a picture of her? But yeah, it's cut from a newspaper that is so just unbearably sweet. So very charming.
So Steve, so
yeah,
early
very
Steve.
Steve. Yeah.
There's something I've been waiting for this minute to talk about, and it's a cut scene from the movie Avengers Endgame, a scene they actually filmed and did not put in the movie. And it's Rhodey, the War Machine, character, talking to Steve Rogers in the present day about the history of the Tesseract. And the dialogue, I transcribed it. The dialogue goes like this. Rhodey opens the scene by saying, "What happened to the Tesseract after that?" And Steve says, "Bottom of the ocean, fell out of the plane after I had to crash it," which actually is not what happened. Rhodey says, "Yeah, I've been meaning to ask, why did you have to crash the plane anyway?" And Steve says, big sigh, "Bombs on board." And Rhodey says, yeah, bombs on board. "And you couldn't have jumped out of the plane before you crashed it?" And I just, it's played for laughs, and I'm so glad they didn't include it because it points out this pretty gaping plot hole and makes Steve look like an absolute idiot who destroyed his life for nothing. Right. Now, we don't see him wearing a parachute. We learn later in later movies that he could survive a jump out of a plane into water because we see him do it in Winter Soldier. But golly, it's just the fact that there's this meta commentary on earlier movies that might have appeared in a later movie is kind of funny to me. I don't know what it is. I'm really glad they didn't include it because it just makes Steve look like an idiot. Why didn't you jump out of the plane?
I'd never come across that deleted scene before. That's good to know. And I agree completely.
Google it, folks.
It would have really undercut this. And yes, we do find later he can jump out of an airplane and survive a pretty good fall into the water. I wonder though, could he do it at these speeds, as he's in this airplane and all he knows he's got to destroy it. So he's just pushing the O4. We're diving.
He can't turn it around. He can't jump out of it. He's only got one option.
Yeah. Put it in a stall and drop out at zero.
Right. But that's another thing too, is we don't see him adjusting the power. Instinctively as a pilot, if you're flying along and you're saying, "I need to get down," one of the first things you're going to do is pull the power probably all the way back. Because as soon as you start descending, you're going to build up speed and you don't want to build up too much. Now, granted, most of the time we don't want to destroy the airplane we're in. So we care about those things. But the fact, my point being is that when he just pushes the nose over without slowing it down, that airplane's going to be going faster and faster. It could easily be going supersonic by the time it comes to the water. Could he survive jumping out, hitting the Bugs Bunny air brakes and hopping out right before it impacts the water or something? I'm not sure even Steve could survive that.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
It reminds me of the fighters that were during World War II, the British Empire, being worldwide, was bringing in fighters from everywhere, and they brought in the Gurkha fighters, which are some of the most hardened fighters from the Indian continent and up in Nepal and stuff like that. Real tough guys, and they were telling them they were going to be part of the paratroopers during the D-Day invasion. They wanted to have a group of them, and they were explaining to them that you'd be jumping out of a plane at 1,000 feet, and the guys were all talking to each other. He says, "You better make it 500. And it was only then that the guy that had been put in charge of them realized that he didn't tell them that they were going to be using parachutes. So it's
better make it 500.
Yeah,
I think we could do 500.
Yeah, we poor guys negotiating this impossible, unsurvivable thing. I would be sadly remiss if I didn't point out, and I don't go hunting for these things, but that gauge when Steve puts the compass with the newspaper picture of Peggy on there, the gauge behind it is I'm struggling to place it exactly, and I feel sort of bad about that, but it's the needles on it suggest that it would be a form of ADF, an automatic direction finder. It's kind of a now obsolete navigational instrument. But basically, if you look around the edge of it, you can see that it's showing the 360 degrees of the compass. And then it starts spinning and spinning. It's got the three needles on it. And it's that the red needle and then that what we'd call the yellow and black barber pole needle. It makes me a little bit unsure exactly what its origin would be, if not, you know, completely fictional. But that's being used visually to show the airplane diving when it's really showing the airplane turning. pretty dramatically. And then maybe the red needle and the white needle are meant in real life might meant to be pointing at two separate stations or whatever. So an altimeter would have been great, but I love this and Joe far too much to spend any more time than I just did nitpicking.
Did Germany have ADF in the 40s?
I believe they would have that. I'll have to just double check like the advent of the NDB. I'm sure that would have been around. And
did it work the same way with the A and the N being broadcast? And that's how.
So that was a separate type of navigation where you've got it was related, but it was distinct because when you didn't have a gauge. So what Jim's talking about is early, this would be pre-World War II radio navigation and was used on up through the 50s, maybe as late as the 60s, because I have a friend who found the last one running when he was an airline pilot in the 60s, and he flew it just for fun, or I guess we were still in the Air Force. But the A and the N is the, Jim, you may know the Morse code for A and N, but they complement each other. And the idea is you tune in this radio frequency, and as you're flying along, it was actually, in effect, a stereo broadcast. And you would hear one letter in one ear and then the other letter in the other ear. So if it was, say, dit da or and da dit, and if you were way off to the left, you would really only hear, I think you're only hearing the left hand side. If you're off to the right, you're only hearing the right hand side. But when you're right in the groove and right down the line, the sounds are equal and then they blend together to form a continuous tone.
Yeah, the A is dit da and N is da dit. So
okay,
No, you said it right.
I guessed right, and so that was a pretty fascinating way to navigate. And then it would have been not too long after that. And again, those stayed around for a while. You know, that was really the first thing after giant white concrete arrows scattered around the country. We still have a few of those.
There are still some. Yeah.
Yeah. But then the ADF, the automatic direction finder, uses the ground counterpart to be an NDB, a non-directional beacon. And really, that's just, it's basically just an AM radio station. And there's a big, unlike most aircraft radio frequencies for communications or navigation, there's a pretty big overlap. And even today, if you have an aircraft that has radio in it, like I used to do this all the time when I wasn't putting girls' pictures on the instrument panel, you could tune in the local AM radio station, just turn up the volume and listen to it. And then there was an added bonus that you would have a single needle on this gauge that wherever you were would point back to that radio station. Mm. So unlike some other radio navigation, it's just simple. You tune in a station and the needle says it's over there.
Poor man's VOR. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. And VORs made them. This point, I was talking to a friend of mine who got her instrument rating a few years ago, and they don't even teach the NDB procedures anymore, and probably haven't for quite a while. But I'm really old.
Well, yeah, I mean that's one of the places that was used to terrible effect was the commercial station in Honolulu, KGMB 590 on your radio dial, was used in Honolulu to for Japanese bombers to zero in on Pearl Harbor, because sure, their station was right up the mountain from Fort Island.
That's a great reminder. I'd forgotten about that, and I did just take a quick peek, and the first practical use of this ADF NDB combination to fly an instrument approach was by the U.S. Army in May of 32. So certainly that had, you know, that was well understood by this point in the film, 10 years, 10, 11 years later.
Am I correct that that was also the first time there was an instrument flight that was using that? Was
So it
instrument?
would be right around that same time. It probably would have been, since this was the first instrument approach, it would have been shortly after that that Jimmy Doolittle, later famous as a racer and legendary for the Doolittle Raid, he made the first completely blind instrument flight. He got in an airplane, and there's the instrument trainer. When they would do instrument training on those early biplanes, you had a canvas hood that it was open cockpit, but then this hood would come over, like a convertible top would come over the cockpit and make it so you absolutely could not see outside. Now, normally you would have an instructor in the other seat that could see, but as you're practicing blind flying in clouds and stuff, but Jimmy Doolittle to prove the validity of this, got in this airplane and closed this hood, couldn't see outside the airplane at all, started the engine, taxied out, took off, flew,
Wow.
and landed safely and taxied in, never having seen outside the airplane at all. And that single flight is why you can get on an airliner today and go anywhere and almost not worry about the weather. My
Wow.
dad had Doolittle on one of his flights one time, and that's how he introduced him. He said, "This flight is made possible by the guy sitting in 2A."
Wow.
And give a big round of applause to Jimmy Doolittle for making instrument flight possible. And to dad, that was almost his biggest contribution to history.
Yeah. By the way, if you can go see, there's a huge exhibit about this at the Cradle of Aviation Museum up in Garden City, Long Island. That's where Doolittle did his first instrument
Oh,
flight,
right.
and he proved that was also where the didn't he also prove the artificial horizon at that point too? That's how reliable Sperry's.
Yeah, I think he certainly would have been working on that. And that would have been a crucial piece of that instrument flight. Would have been that artificial horizon, which of course makes me think of Stephen Wright in So I Married an Axe Murderer. He's flying along a little 150 in the storm, and he points out the artificial horizon and why it's better than the real horizon. I don't know. He was not wrong. Like
No,
an
that's right. Yeah.
instrument, it is definitely safer than trying to find the real horizon that you can't see. But
Yeah. But I can strongly, along with going to the EAA Museum in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, I can strongly recommend if you have any interest in being an aviation nerd, get yourself to the Cradle of Aviation Museum because it is quite a facility out there on Long Island. Lots of history all just orbiting out there. So.
that's a good endorsement. I used to be acquainted with some of the folks that ran it, but I still to this day have not made it out there. So next time I'm in the neighborhood.
Wow. Well,
And then of course, when you're done there, go to the other coast and go see Brian's daughter at the Hornet.
yes.
Yeah. Well, the Hornet does a lot, maintains a lot of history on the Doolittle Raid, although they were not physically the ship that launched the Doolittle Raid. That was the earlier Hornet, the
One
CV-8.
Hornet ago, yeah.
And my daughter's is the CV-12, which was launched in, I believe, 44. But they still carry on the tradition of the name. They honor all the Hornets that came before them, and they still put on quite a number of programs and exhibitions, exhibits about Doolittle. I think, don't quote me on this. I think they've got a permanent exhibit on one of the decks about the Doolittle Raid. But yeah, please, but go visit the Hornet.
Yeah. A ask for Laura and
Absolutely.
mention this podcast, and you'll get a free eye roll.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
Tell
one
them
that can
Laura's
be
dad
heard all the
sent
way
you.
across the bay.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, a free
Wow.
eye roll.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been quite a show. I think we've got 10 more to go, so hang in there.
We're just going to get sillier and sillier as we go.
Yeah. Well, it's you gotta get ready for poor Peggy is about to become a war widow, and she's not even married to him.
Oh,
But
yeah.
just gonna hang in
Well,
and
there is a tragedy at the heart of this story, of Captain America's story. And of course, we're having fun with the podcast, but in the story's own terms, it's really just coming down to the nub here. And I'm gonna respect that solemnity when we get to it.
yeah, it's
Yeah.
Captain America's job is to be a hero, and this is the rough part of being a hero. Wow. Well,
Absolutely.
if you would like to continue this conversation about this, of course, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, Captain America Minute Listeners Base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, we've only got a couple more left, but don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We got a couple coming up. Fingers crossed that we get this all recorded in time, but check us out soon. And also be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.